Judge Vasey, honored guests, and brethren of the church. I saw the judge at another meeting a few days ago, and he said, if there's anything you want me to say, tell me. If there's anything you want me not to say, you better tell me. And I said, no, you just use your own judgment. I'll throw myself on the mercy of the court, which was a mistake. I did get one good break, though. If he told that story before a bunch of preachers, then I had a worse reaction than you got right there. Well, this is the ninth one of these luncheons, and I can hardly believe it's 9 years that I have been coming here. And I look forward to it with great anticipation, and always it's a great experience for me. I don't think any bishop in the church, our church, has such an opportunity and such a wonderful occasion. They go so fast these years, it worries me a little. They go faster each year. Maybe it seems the same way to you. And one of the great things about it is that we have these honored guests, these leaders of our city and county, who come, some of them year after year. And I want them to know how much I appreciate it personally and how our church feels honored in their attendance. This is a great city. I'm proud of my city. I was traveling in Europe this last fall and found a wonderful article in an English paper. I've forgotten where it was, a European paper, on our sheriff. I was going to write you a note, sheriff, and tell you there was a whole page article about the kind of things you're doing and the mounted posse and so on that is most thrilling. I was talking to a fellow not long ago from Chicago. I was over in Arizona, and he was telling me about his city. And after he got through telling me about all the corruption and all the rest of it, I said to him, I'm glad I don't live there. And our city's not like that. I want to say to our chief of police that I would guess that because of his position, from time to time, he gets criticized. I'm not sure about that, but I assume that once in a while that happens. But I want to tell him that I, as a citizen of this city, think he's doing a mighty fine job, and I appreciate it. Doesn't bother me a bit when he makes some of these gangsters have a rough time and disturbs them and follows them around and let them know his eye is on them. And I know that constantly there's pressure upon a city for these elements to come in. Unless we have men from the mayor on down, standing guard, we do not preserve a city like this. And I want to pledge to these brethren that although sometimes we're very hesitant speaking and sometimes it seems as if we only complain, but I hope they will feel that the laymen of our church are back of them constantly. I know I remember them all in my prayers every night because they have a hard job and they're doing a good job, and we're for you and we're with you. Now, I was in Athens last September. Well, no, it was really the first part of October. The first time I'd ever visited Athens. And beside the fact they also have smog, I found something else interesting in Athens. There on the hill of the Acropolis, which looms over the whole city, you see the ruins of some of the most beautiful buildings man ever built. I have been told that the Parthenon is perhaps the most perfectly proportioned building ever constructed. And I got a great thrill out of that. And down below that hill on one side, there is the old Roman agora, the marketplace, the center, the city center. And that's a thrilling place to go, and we walked down through there. And then on our way back to the hotel one morning, we followed back around, and we came just outside that marketplace into a slum section of the city. And like all slum sections, it makes you sick of what men can do when they get together, when they just let things go to pieces, the filth, the dirt, the vice. And I thought to myself as I walked through their day, I wonder if these people here ever look up to the Acropolis and say to themselves, our fathers built that. And we are the descendants of those men. This is who we are. This is from whence we have come. I wonder if they ever take the time to just look up and remember. I don't know. And then I got to thinking about my own life, and I got to thinking about my own church, and I said to myself, do we ever think of our own tradition? Do we ever think of our fathers? Do we ever think of the tradition which has given us what we have? Do we ever stop and consider what it means to be the spiritual children of John Wesley? And I'm afraid not. And today I want to talk to you about our church, about the marks of a Methodist. I want to say to these brethren who don't belong to our church, please don't think I'm doing this in any pride or any sense of superiority. If I were a Presbyterian, I would want this done. If I went to the synagogue, I would want this done for me. If I were a Catholic, I'd want this done. I'd want to be reminded of the tradition to which I belong and of the part of society that I give my strength to. I do this in no narrow way. But somehow today I would like to speak for a little while about our heritage, about our marks. John Wesley, in the beginning, wrote a tract which he called The Character of a Methodist. He was trying to say to the people of that generation, this is who you are, this is what you ought to be, this is where you're different. You don't do that much anymore. I want to say four things to you. First, the mark of a Methodist is this: a man has had a great experience of God. We believe in experience. We believe that something can happen to a man that will change his life. We can believe that there can come to him an assurance, a sense that there's an answer to his problems and there's power to live by. We believe that a man may know that God is, and his God is with him. John Wesley had it for a decade. He was a disciplined man, more disciplined than I am or you are. He sought this thing with all his might. He didn't find it. And then he writes, you remember, that his heart was strangely warmed one night in a little meeting. And suddenly, a tide began to flow. Something had happened. He'd been found in a new way, a strange way. Now there's a man in this country whose name you know, Norman Vincent Peale. He's a successful man. And whenever a preacher doesn't know what else to do, he usually criticizes Peale. I've all been guilty of it. I was in New York some time ago, a few years ago, and I went to church on a Sunday morning. That's news for you. And I decided to go and hear Norman Vincent Peale. Never heard him preach. I went somewhat prejudiced. I remember the subject of his sermon, How to Make Life Easier. I didn't like it. I don't think that's what we need primarily. But I've never forgotten that morning experience. Dr. Peale stood up for the morning prayer, and I remember the prayer. He said something like this: Oh God, when thy son walked the earth, people believed if they could come close enough to touch his garment, they could be healed. And we believe this morning that we can reach out our spiritual arms, and with faith we can touch him and we can be healed. That helped me. I needed healing that morning. He spoke that day of the answers to prayer. He spoke that day of power released in men's lives. He spoke that day of the solution to human problems. And I left there and I felt good. And I said to myself, I'm through criticizing this man. He can do something I can't do, and he has something in a service that's given me a lift, and many of our services don't have that. Too many of our worship services, brethren, we go to with no expectation, and we're not disappointed. Nothing happened, just dull, it's dreary, we leave, having gone through the motions, but we haven't been lifted or strengthened. That wasn't always true. Our fathers believed that on a Sunday morning a man might have his life changed. You might leave that place not as you came. And they moved expectantly. They saw this thing work. They believed in the possibility, the inevitability of a great experience if a man knocked on the door and asked for it. Now, we're not very theological Methodists. We've been looked down upon for that. We have been regarded as taking theology rather easily, but I'll tell you this morning where our theology is in the hymns of Charles Wesley. Our fathers sang their theology. And that's where theology ought to be. I'd rather hear it sung and recited. And I'm on a one-man crusade to bring back into our church something of these great Wesleyan hymns, that we learn them again and we sing them as our fathers sang them. Because there they talk about the experience of being found by God, having your life changed. When I was a small boy, I used to recite poetry. I was pretty good at it. And my mother thought so. And I had a favorite poem which I had learned. I could do it with gestures. I was really very, very effective in this. And whenever people came to our house, if she could corner me and corner them, I usually gave them this poem. I only remember the opening lines. The boy stood on the burning deck when all but him had fled. Great poem. And I had an admiration for that boy, of course, because I recited it so much. I read the other day where a psychologist analyzed that poem. He said this kid was just a dumb cluck who couldn't adjust himself to a new situation. I'm glad I didn't have any psychologists around when I was young. Ruined that for me. But it brought me this understanding that you see everything according to your experience. You look out and you discover new things according to what's happened to you. The poem looks different to a simple-minded boy than it does to a sophisticated psychologist. And all of life is a matter of where we look from and from what basis we take our point of view and what we stand on. This is the place, and this is where we have to begin. Our fathers believe that if a man has an experience of God, if God finds a man, life will look differently to him, and his own life will look differently, and his brethren. They believed in an experience of God. That's one thing. Now, the second thing I want to say is this. They believed in results, and that's rather radical teaching today. They thought something ought to happen. We don't. Nothing's happened in some of our churches for so long that we'd faint, like your man back there at the court. If anybody got saved, if anything really happened that said to us there's power in this thing, shock us to death. We're afraid of results. The story about two young seminary students talking together. Bishop Martin told me this. One said to the other, "How's it going?" He said, "Not good." He says, "The Sunday school's way down. Not many people come to church. Finances are poor." The other boy said, "Well, what's the matter with you? You expect results?" Some of my preachers don't expect results. They're scared to death to have a count of whether we've gained or lost. That's not according to the Holy Spirit. We're so afraid of organization. We'd rather sit around and do nothing ecumenically than to do something denominationally. Charlie Wesley didn't believe that. Whenever they attacked him, and that was very often, he didn't try to justify himself, except on this basis. He said, "All right, look at these people. Here's a liar who has now become a truthful man. Here's a drunkard who has become sober. Here's a wife beater who has become a good husband. Look at that," and then criticize. He turned to the gin-soaked east end of London, and he said, "Look what's happened down there among the Methodists, where we have established our work. Now criticize that if you want to." But he always threw the thing directly back to results. I take my stand this morning on this. Some of you heard me tell this. I was with Bishop Oxnam a couple of years ago in Istanbul. I was the guest of the Ecumenical Patriarch. We were there on a Sunday, and he wanted us to come to church. He said, "Come an hour late. I'll send my car for you." I couldn't understand it, but I understood it after I got there, because the service still went on for a couple of hours. Long service. And the people stand. And after it was over, I noticed there were hardly any young people there. There weren't many people of any age there, as a matter of fact. And when it was all over, and we had lunch with the Ecumenical Patriarch, he said to us, "Really, we ought to revise this service. It's too long." But he said, "That would take an ecumenical conference." I said, "When was the last one?" He said, "In the 8th century. I said, "Why don't you call another one?" He said, "We're not quite ready." I thought, of our church, we meet every 4 years and we tamper with everything, including the ritual. We have the idea that maybe if you change this law or that or that, or bring in some more regulation, we'll do it. Well, we don't do it that way. But I'm glad to belong to a fellowship that believes that if the thing isn't being done, we better find out why. If the method that our fathers used doesn't work now, then we'll find a new method. Above everything else, we take our stand on this, that if we are doing God's work, we'll get some results. And we'll see it in our society and among our own people and in our own lives. There was an old boy one time who was asked by a member of his congregation to preach a sermon on election. He was a Methodist, but he said, "All right, I will preach a sermon on predestination, election." In his sermon, he said this. The situation, brethren, is very simple. He said, in every situation, there are three votes. He said, the devil votes, he's always against you. God votes, he's for you. You cast the deciding vote, and that's the election. I'm not sure my Presbyterian brethren would agree with that interpretation, but it's good for me. I like that. I'll go for election on that basis. I have the feeling today that we need to recapture a faith which our fathers had, and a confidence that if they're doing the work, and if God's pleased with it, and it's according to his will, they'll see some results from that work. Now, a third mark which I want to speak to you briefly about is discipline. We have a little book in our church, brethren. Those of you who don't know about this, it's called The Discipline. It's a great book. You may not find a Bible in every preacher's study, but you'll find the discipline there. It's a role that God, that tells them where they go, what they can do. So, it's a little book which gets larger every 4 years. We always add to it. We never take out of it. But it tells every Methodist layman where he stands, tells every Methodist preacher where he stands, and every Methodist bishop what he can do and what he can't do. We have an idea that everybody ought to know where he stands. We'll save a lot of time. We don't have to debate it every time. We don't have to have an argument about it every time. Here it is, written right here. You go by the discipline. And the older I've grown, the more I've had a great respect born in my heart and mind for that book. I don't know a book that I've read anywhere that seems to me to be a better balance between authority and freedom than the Methodist discipline. There it is. We are supposed to be a disciplined people. John Wesley brought that down to us. We're disciplined. We ought to get up at 4 a.m, he said. We ought to have every minute of the day planned. Don't waste any time. Don't stay in one place longer than necessary. He said that. Well, now I would speak a brief word to our preachers here. There aren't too many of them here. There's some, and I say this to them from time to time. We have come into a generation when many of us are feeling sorry for ourselves as preachers. The psychologists are to blame. They tell us that we can't possibly do our job without having a nervous breakdown. A fellow begins to feel guilty if he doesn't crack up a little while. Something wrong with it. A man wrote an article in Life magazine from Yale University a few years ago. He showed that under the present situation with the tensions and all the rest of it, you can't possibly do the job. I don't know what these boys worry about. I'm the fellow who ought to crack up. I have to worry about them. I have to put them somewhere. We never throw a man out of our ministry for laziness or anything like that. They ought to go to bed every night, sleep like babies. They're secure. Well, I want to say this about the ministry, and I say this to the layman now. You hear me. There isn't a tougher job in society than being a preacher. Not a tougher job. I know it's hard work. You just analyze what you expect of a man. He's supposed to preach with no time to study. He's supposed to be a great pastor. He's supposed to sense when you're sick without ever having any word spoken to him. And you get mad if he isn't there right away. He's supposed to be an administrator. He's a public relations man. Any man that looks at the ministry, the Protestant ministry today, knows he's not up to it. You can't do it. And it's the toughest job I know. But to the ministers, I'd say, boys, it isn't going to get any better. It's going to get worse. The only way we can carry the load which the church and which God puts upon us is to be the most disciplined men in our community. We have to discipline ourselves physically. We have to discipline ourselves spiritually. We have to be disciplined morally. We shall be disciplined men or we will crack up. That's true. But I want to speak this word to the layman here. Does it trouble you, brethren, at all to realize in the very day when there are more church members in this country than at any time in our history, we are not better than we are? I don't think Chief Parker would say there's less juvenile delinquency. And his job is easier because there's so many church members? What does it mean to be a church member? That's what I want to know. What does it mean? Does it make any difference at all? And I know that once in a while one of you men will come to me and say, I don't do this anymore and I used to do it, but nobody else is doing it. Or I do this now and I didn't used to think it was right and I still have a question about it, but everybody else is doing it. I wonder what Wesley would say to you if you came to him with a word like that. I know what I feel like saying. And I lay this upon your conscience today, my brethren of the Methodist Church. Until the time comes when along with the ministry, the laity of our church decides to discipline itself, we shall still have members and mighty little power. And a man who follows in this train is a man who has made certain promises to rule his life with certain observations and obligations. Billy Sunday used to say, they tell me I rub the fur the wrong way. Well, he says, if that's the case, let the cat turn around. I And the truth is that for many of us, and I expect some of us here today, life isn't too good for us, and we don't know why. We don't get up in the morning with any great sense of expectancy. We are under strain. There's something missing, and we know it. And I would say to you today, that might be God rubbing the fur the wrong way, and he's saying to us, you better turn around. You better turn around. There's some things a man has to do, and there are obligations a man has to accept. I call upon our church once again to remember that the sign and the mark of Methodism has been discipline. Discipline. Sometimes we've been called pretty narrow, and sometimes we've been called rather unreasonable. I'll take a chance on that side any day in the year, rather than have a fellowship made up of people who just go the easiest way, wherever that way may lead. Now, the last thing I want to say to you today is the Methodists have the mark of perfection. That's a strange thing. If we have a unique theological doctrine, it is this: we believe in Christian perfection. Just to say that to you sounds strange, doesn't it? I can imagine you boys say, why bring that up? Well, I haven't brought it up before. I read that doctrine of Christian perfection when I was a student, and I found out that John Wesley had to spend about as much time telling what he didn't mean as he did what he did mean, and I said, I'm going to leave it out, and I have. And I think I've been wrong. He was always being attacked by saying he was preaching sinlessness. He said, no, that isn't it. They said to him, you're trying to tell us that a man can be perfect in his judgment. No, he said, that isn't it at all. He said we ought to aim for nothing less than this, to be perfect in our motives. To have our heart filled with the love of God, to desire with every bit of our being to do God's will. He said, that's what I mean by perfectly loving God, by perfectly desiring the very best. That's what he meant. Now, every time, every year at conference, when young men come into the conference, the bishop always has to ask them that question. We've asked it ever since Wesley's day. Are you going on to Christian perfection? And this bothers the boys sometimes. They hate to promise that. It sounds like they're promising more than they can possibly fulfill. And sometimes they stutter on it, and sometimes they come and see me ahead of time. Well, I'm helped when a boy comes and asks about that question by a word an old bishop spoke some time ago in the same situation. He said, son, what are you going on to? You better go on to something. You're not there yet. Is there anything less than the perfect to aim for, to go toward? Is there? Jesus didn't think so. There in the Sermon on the Mount, he didn't say to those fellows, well, now, boys, do the best you can. I want to be reasonable about this. He said to them, be ye perfect even as your Father is perfect. And we never forgot what he said. One of the things that's wrong with this generation, in my judgment, is that we are content with little things and small matters and mediocre accomplishments. The church is too content with second-rate production. I've decided that maybe what needs to be done is to have somebody come back into our church with this message of Christian perfection, to say to this generation, we believe that we ought to aim for nothing less than the best. And if we don't make it, the crime will not be because we aim too low. At least that. Can you in your imagination today think of what that movement was in the 18th century that dared to go out across England and say, we're aiming for perfection? Think of the enthusiasm in that. Think of that. One of the retired and honored pastors of this conference said to me not too long ago, Bishop, can't you teach these young fellows to be enthusiastic? I can't. I don't know how. An old layman in his 80s said to me not too long ago, he said, I hear these young men preach, and they're good preachers, they're bright boys. But he said, so often they don't act as if they're really sold on what they're saying. And I knew what he meant. Let me quote that authority in so many fields today, Mort Saul. He has some wise words to speak. He said, somewhere, he said, I wish I had a cause, because I've sure got a lot of enthusiasm. And we reverse it.
We've got the cause all right, but we're shy on enthusiasm. We don't act as if we really meant it. We don't get very excited about it.
They went out and they said, and this was to the poor as well as to the rich, and to the ignorant as well as to the learned, we'll aim for the very highest.
Think of what this meant in terms of hope.
You see, you never get any good news in the newspaper, hardly, do you? We had a strange idea that all dramatic news has to be bad news. Headlines don't encourage us. That's why we get so pessimistic. Everything's wrong with us. And there's much that's wrong.
Nothing's going right with us.
But those preachers came along and they said, we've got another word for you. We've got some good news for you.
Good news.
That's what that old boy used to say, Bishop Taylor, before he was a bishop, when in San Francisco he stood on the barrel on Sunday morning and said to those who gathered around him, the miners and all the rest, thank God I've good news for you this morning. Got some good news for you.
So we read our Bible. And we hear a word which doesn't make the headlines. And we dare to stand before people and say, we've got some good news. Lift up your heart. Lift up your heart. All the faith they must have had to believe that they dared to announce they were going down for perfection and nothing less. The faith. We got a strange idea in our time. If you have faith in God, you're not supposed to have any faith in men. We've got a theology today that looks down upon any man who decides that maybe there's something hopeful about men.
You believe in God, but don't believe in men. I think that's nonsense. I remember the word of the gospel. God so loved the world. Let me tell you today, if God loved it, it can't be all bad. It isn't hopeless. And I'm going to have a little faith in it, and a little faith in tomorrow.
I cannot believe today that God sent his only son, and while we were yet sinners, he died for us, that there isn't something within us that's redeemable, and something good.
I'm going to believe in men. And I'm going to have some faith in the future. And I'm going to try and get back to something of that experience which our fathers had when under the leadership of Wesley, they said, we believe we ought to aim for perfection and we're going to hold that standard and nothing less before us. Close with this. There was an old missionary who'd been out in a hard place to work, been out there all his life. He'd lived with the people and didn't have anything of the conveniences we have, very rough living. The field was hard, nobody responded much. He would work a long time to get one convert. He never had a crowd. He never knew what it was to speak to a group like this. And after all the long years of his life, he came to the age of retirement, came home. He couldn't get over the luxury of America. It shocked him that life would be so good for some and so hard for others. And one day at a theological seminary, they invited the old man to come over and talk to the students, which was a mistake. He had some things he wanted to say. And he said to those young men, you have it so easy. You have so many advantages, so well taken care of. Then he told about his own life out there, what he'd been through. And this was his conclusion. Listen to this. He said, if you're not careful, you young men, you're going to die in your beds. And then he added, and it will serve you right. And I wonder if that's not the word that we need to have said to us in our time. Not only to preachers, but to laymen alike. Pretty easy we've had it. Maybe the time has come when God is saying to us, you will not keep it on this basis. No, you won't. Maybe we have to find again what St. Paul meant. You remember when he wrote to the Galatians, he said, let no man trouble me. I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. How many marks do you have? How many? Or do I have? The Lord bless you.